Will you be able to retire on your 401k?
Minimally, anyone who's in one of these 401k plans loses 20% minimally in terms of whatever they would have gained goes out in fees. So it just has not worked to be able to build up enough money to finance retirement. I can actually give you the figure. The Federal Reserve Survey on Consumer Finance shows that the average person in a 401k approaching retirement that is over 55 years old has only $100,000 built up. Now, $100,000 sounds like a lot of money, but if you think, can that support you for the rest of your life? Well, the experts say you should only take out 4% a year. Well, do the math, and that's $4,000 a year. I mean, hardly a generous retirement income for anyone, even if you add that to your Social Security.
That's James W. Russell. He got a shock in 2008, like hundreds of thousands of other Americans who thought their 401ks were going to give them a comfortable retirement. What he's found out since, he's put into his explosive book, Social Insecurity, 401ks and the Retirement Crisis. We spend the hour talking with him about 401ks, pension plans, and Social Security, and what can be done to make sure we don't end up poor in our old age. Thanks for joining us this hour on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Everywhere, we hear the litany of doom about the retirement crisis. Social Security is supposed to be going broke fast. Politicians from President Obama to presidential hopeful Rand Paul want it cut and privatized, at least in part. We're told public sector pensions will bankrupt governments unless their promises to workers are abandoned. We also hear that 401ks are supposed to be our salvation. Just keep socking away the maximum allowable amount in your 401k or similar plan every year, and you'll be sitting pretty, we're told. Well, that's what my guest James W. Russell thought until the financial crash of 2008 took a giant bite out of his retirement nest egg. A professor of sociology at Eastern Connecticut State University, he used his research skills to look into the matter more closely. What he found shocked him. The old-style pension plans that have all but disappeared, called defined benefit plans, were way better than the defined contribution plans, 401ks and the like, that have replaced them. And Social Security gives the best return of all, not just for old folks, but also for the disabled and for younger family members who don't have to bankrupt themselves supporting their aged parents or grandparents. Even more, what's happened to retirement plans since the 1980s represents a huge transfer of wealth from workers to Wall Street. Just to set the stage, let's hear this edited audio from a video by the organization Strengthen Social Security.
Imagine if you had a business with no debt, and it could pay every penny of its bills for the next quarter century. Well, you do. It's called Social Security. But I bet you've heard, Social Security is just a bunch of worthless IOUs. False. Young workers will never see a penny in benefits. Social Security is a liberal plot to destroy America. Sorry. False again. These are all lies we've been led to believe. The truth is, Social Security has been paying its own way since day one. We all pay in when we're working, so it's there for us and our families when we need it. Hey, we earned it, and no one should ever try to take it away. So, who wants us to think Social Security is failing? Meet Billy Bankster, Wall Street banker and pension fund raider. He's worth billions, but thinks you're the one with too much money. So, he wants to cut your Social Security. Yeah, and he runs with the same crowd that helped Bush try to privatize Social Security back in 2005. Social Security isn't at risk, except from the people trying to destroy it. Look, Congress can fix Social Security without cutting the benefits you've earned, with a few simple adjustments that require Wall Street fat cats to pay their share. More than fair, given they're the ones who crashed the economy. Social Security is America's family protection plan, and it works. It works for America. It works for everyone.
That was an edited clip from a video by the organization Strengthen Social Security. We'll be talking about Social Security, pensions, and 401ks this hour with James W. Russell. His book is Social Insecurity, 401ks, and the Retirement Crisis. It's out from Beacon Press. James W. Russell is an expert and activist in retirement policy. In addition to Social Insecurity, he's the author of 7 other books, and he is also the co-chairperson of the Connecticut Committee for Equity in Retirement. It's a rank-and-file advocacy group that initiated a union campaign that won the right of public employees in Connecticut to transfer from their failing 401k-type plan to the state's traditional pension. Well, James W. Russell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for having me on.
When the stock market crashed in 2008, you lost a quarter of what you had accumulated in your retirement account. Now, you're a professor and a pretty savvy guy, and you were in what has been touted as a very safe, respectable retirement fund, TIAA CREF. I've seen their ads all over the place, very highly rated. What happened?
Well, first I'll have to disagree that I wasn't very savvy when I started in TIAA in the 1980s. I think I was like most other people who took it on faith that this was a retirement program that would be fine. It was only when I began to examine the numbers in the 1990s that I realized that this was a very inferior plan. I mean, it's somewhat of a myth that TIAA CREF is kind of the good 401k plan. It is no better and no worse than the other ones that are out there. The problem is that none of these plans come close to a traditional pension in terms of replacement of income when you retire. In my case, I found out that I was paying in twice as much in terms of contributions, yet I would receive half the benefits compared to a traditional pension plan. When I found that out, I tried to explain it to my fellow professors, and they didn't want to hear it. They thought they were all becoming retirement millionaires in the 1990s. It was only in 2008 that there was very much of a rude awakening when, on average, around the country, a quarter of people's retirement savings went up in smoke.
Right. They went up in smoke. But you say, you did a little bit of investigating, and you were shocked to find out that even if there had been a bull market, you would not have done better than a defined benefit plan, the traditional pension plan.
That's right. Because even in the 1990s, when there was very much of a bull market, when I did the numbers and compared them, I was able to detect this really severe difference in the payout. And anyone who has done those numbers has come up with the same result. The problem is that for a lot of people, it's very difficult to do those numbers. They're not readily available, or they don't know how to do them. And so they've taken it on faith, as I did, that if you invest over the long term and you don't pull your money out, that you'll be fine. But I'm here to tell you, you won't be fine, and that's why we got involved in this whole reform effort in Connecticut to allow us to go back into a regular pension plan.
And we will be talking much more about what you did in Connecticut to remedy the situation. But first, you know, we just hear ad nauseum that there's a retirement crisis and that in order to protect our retirement, we should be investing the maximum amount that we can into our 401ks. You enumerate a number of myths about the 401ks. Could you give us a sense of what those myths are? What are some of the major misunderstandings of the situation?
Well, the first one, which was when the 401k really began to take off, which was in the 1980s, was that it would produce more retirement income than the pensions that it was replacing. And that that was believed, I think, by a lot of people. But it was based on very optimistic assumptions about the stock market. And then when you get the first generation of people in the late 1990s actually trying to retire under these things, and they realize that they're getting dramatically less income, the story changes to the 401k is the only sustainable type of plan because the traditional pension plan is too expensive. But that turns out to be a myth also, because if you look at the studies of, if you put a certain amount of money into a retirement plan, if you put it into a traditional pension, it will pay much better. And so it's actually dollar for dollar a cheaper plan to finance. And then there are other myths that are out there, that Social Security is going broke, that it needs to be privatized or have its benefits reduced, that unfunded liabilities of state employee plans are, you know, you're going to bankrupt state government. It's just a whole, the air is totally polluted with all kinds of misconceptions about retirement plans. And I think a lot of people are simply unequipped to be able to make sense of what's going on.
Social Security isn't going broke?
No. No, it's a very stable program. Does it need adjustments? Yes, it always has from the beginning. When the actuarial conditions change, minor adjustments need to be made to keep everything flowing right. And indeed, it has over the years, and there is no problem that without minor adjustments, no problem that can't be fixed.
One of the points you make in the book that I found very interesting and I never thought about in that way is that Social Security was set up as one of three legs of a retirement system. And of course, if we understand a three-legged stool, all three legs have to be equal. What are those three legs and what is the current situation with that?
Well, this is very much of an American analogy in terms of the way our system of retirement has evolved, that I would say the three-legged stool analogy was most used in maybe the 1960s, 1970s, before the 401k. And in that analogy, you should have three sources of income in your retirement. You should have Social Security, which was set up never to provide all of your income, but part of your income. You should have a traditional pension from your work, and then you should have retirement savings. Now, there were always problems with this analogy. You know, nobody had equal legs that were there. I mean, it turned out that Social Security evolved into the strongest leg of the system, as it is today. For over half of people in it, it provides the most amount of income, and for a substantial number of people, it's the only income that they have in retirement. And then the second leg of a pension, only about half of private sector workers had a retirement plan, so there was no second leg for a number of people. And then if you look at people's personal savings, they're even more depressing. So, you know, we never had this kind of balanced three-legged stool. But then in the 1980s, for those people who did have the second leg of a secure pension from work, that leg got a severe kick from the 401k when it replaced it with a very, very weak leg. Keep going with this hackneyed analogy here.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James W. Russell about his book, Social Insecurity, 401ks and the Retirement Crisis. It's out from Beacon Press, and it's a must-read. So explain the difference between a defined pension, defined benefit plan, which was the way, you know, something like two-thirds of people who had pension plans were in those defined benefit plans until 1981, the Reagan watershed, I call it. And now there's only 19% that have that. What's the difference between defined benefit and defined contribution? How do they work differently?
Sure. With a defined benefit pension, what you're doing is you're making contributions to what is essentially insurance. And the insurance is that you're insuring yourself that you're not going to outlive your money. So that when you retire, first, all of this money goes into a collective pool with other people who pay insurance. Again, I like to call it insurance. It goes into that pool. And then when you retire, money comes out of that pool that is guaranteed. You know what to expect. The usual formula is that it's based on the number of years you work multiplied by some multiplier, and then that as a percentage of final income. Okay? I mean, there are all kinds of variations, but that's the general idea. So it's very much of a collective plan. The idea of the 401k is that you have no guarantees as to what you're going to get in retirement. Now, the way it's set up is that you and your employer, maybe, maybe not, because not all employers match, contribute to a fund which is yours. Okay, it's not shared with other people. It's a savings account. I mean, this is one of, I think, the great differences, the difference between social insurance and savings. And so you build up the savings account and you invest it in the stock market, and then you're supposed to build up enough money so that when you retire, it will support you for the rest of your life. I mean, that's the way it's supposed to work in theory. To kind of think of the next question, why hasn't it worked? Well, it turns out that, number one, people didn't have enough money to put into them to be able to provide enough for retirement. By my estimate, people would have to put in between 25 and 30% of their income in order to make these things pay off, as well as traditional pensions do. And then there are a series of other problems. Most people, when it comes to investing, and I include myself in this group, are rank amateurs. We don't really know how to invest, and we're going up against companies that have computer programs and all kinds of things. And so people are not professional investors. There's a lot of drainage that comes out of the system because people can treat it as savings and withdraw money and then not put it in. And then, of course, one of the really big ones is that when you put money in these accounts, they become kind of sitting ducks for all kinds of fees and profit-taking and commissions. Minimally, anyone who's in one of these 401k plans loses 20% minimally in terms of whatever they would have gained goes out in terms of fees. So it just has not worked to be able to build up enough money to finance retirement. I can actually give you the figure. The Federal Reserve Survey on Consumer Finance shows that the average person in a 401k approaching retirement, that is over 55 years old, has only $100,000 built up. Now, $100,000 sounds like a lot of money, but if you think, can that support you for the rest of your life? Well, the experts say you should only take out 4% a year. Well, do the math, and that's $4,000 a year. I mean, hardly a generous retirement income for anyone, even if you add that to your Social Security.
Wow. That's a shocking figure. And, of course, there are huge numbers of Americans who have absolutely no savings at all or have negative savings.
That's right. And that's why Social Security ends up being incredibly important in this whole discussion. You can't have the discussion without Social Security because it is the absolute backup to all the failures of the private market solutions to this this problem.
How did this happen? You would think that such a system that is trying to fix something that is not broken by actually breaking it would have never passed muster. How did this happen?
Well, some of it is ideological. That is, if you go back to some very conservative writing from Milton Friedman, and the Cato Institute, and the Heritage Foundation, that all of them like the idea of individuals providing for themselves in retirement, and they like the idea that people's retirement would go through the stock market and Wall Street to be a part of just the general business income that's out there. And so the financial services industry has been able to really manage these accounts and really draw enormous profits off of them. In fact, there's a direct relationship between the popularity of these accounts or the prevalence of these accounts and the expansion of the financial services industry in the United States. And so there were interests that were involved in it. There was a bit of ideology that was involved in it. There was also a part of it that is not talked about so much, but there's a very good book called Retirement Heist by Ellen Schultz. And she looks at a lot of the pension plans in the 1980s and finds out that they were actually in very good shape financially. And it became tempting to raid those plans by companies. And so a number of them were overfunded. And if you could pay off the amount that you had an accrued liability for, they could sweep the overfunded part. So, I mean, that's what she refers to as the retirement heist. I can give you a very recent example when Jeff Bezos of Amazon bought the Washington Post. The Washington Post had a pension fund that was funded at 141%. In other words, it was incredibly overfunded, so that there was no problem with that plan whatsoever. He has nevertheless converted it into a defined contribution plan. So why, you know, why would he do? Why would you take a plan that's very successful and, you know, substitute for it one that we now know doesn't work very well for employees? Well, that 41% that's overfunded, he's able to use for other things. And so from an accountant's point of view, it becomes very tempting to raid the pension plan that's in existence. So there's a lot of things that are involved in that as to why that occurred in the 1980s and then accelerated. And it's going on today. I mean, I read business publications, and they're all the time conferences, regarding pensions called de-risking. And what that means is that management, instead of having the responsibility to provide a pension and to make sure that it works financially, can now shift the risk to the employee, which is to set up a 401k type plan.
We're talking with James W. Russell about his book, Social Insecurity, 401ks and the Retirement Crisis. It's out from Beacon Press. You mentioned before the ideological shift, and you talked about Milton Friedman and the Heritage Foundation, the Cato Institute. I found this section of your book, and by the way, I found your book extremely easy to read. I mean, very well written. For getting into the weeds as you do in retirement issues and these financial issues, I found it extremely clear. But this was a very interesting section. The idea that capitalism equals freedom equals democracy. I wonder if you could just say a little bit more about that and then give us the example of Chile, a place where capitalism equaled neither freedom nor democracy.
Right. Chile is a big part of the story, because if you go back to the 1981 which is the year in which the 401k takes off in the United States. It's also the year in which Chile, under a minister of labor by the name of Jose Piñera, who is a follower of Milton Friedman, a very, very conservative guy in terms of economics, or what's called neoliberal economics in Latin America, that he completely privatizes the Chilean social security system. It's the first time in the world that that ever happens. And that is, during the period, the rest of the period of the dictator, this is under conditions of a military dictatorship. You know, it's the sort of thing that if Ronald Reagan had wanted to do it in the United States, he wouldn't have been able to, because there would have been too many democratic pressures. But you could do it under conditions of a military dictatorship. Well, for the rest of the 1980s, while the dictatorship still existed in Chile, nobody really wanted to touch this, but a lot of financial interests were looking at it. Then when the dictatorship ended in 1991, the World Bank basically took over the campaign to privatize Social Security accounts. In 1994, it published a book called Averting the Old Age Crisis. And if anybody wants to know what the politics of Social Security are, you should read Averting the Old Age Crisis, because it calls for privatization of national retirement systems like Social Security, and it held Chile up as a model. Well, the thing is that nobody really knew what was going to happen in Chile, and the plan spectacularly failed by the end of the 1990s. Not coincidentally, Jose Piñera leaves Chile, ends up in Washington working for the Cato Institute on, guess what, its Social Security privatization project for the United States. And then George W. Bush in 2005, in his attempt to at least partially privatize Social Security, cites the Chilean model. So Chile is very big in this, but the system is a disaster now in Chile, and it's continued to be a problem. It was the major issue in the 2005 election. They did a small reform to it, but it didn't fix the whole problem, and it continues to be something that is being debated, and the Bachelet administration will have to deal with it.
You mentioned that George W. Bush tried to partially privatize Social Security in 2005. What did he try to do, and what was the reaction?
Well, he wanted to set it up so that you could divert part of the contribution that goes into Social Security into a private investment account. Right now, if you're in Social Security and 94% of people who have jobs are in it, 6.2% of your salary goes into Social Security. It's what's called FICA, if you look at your payroll stub. And then your employer puts in 6.2%. And that's the way the system is financed. And he wanted to set it up so that you could divert 3% of that and create your own private account. Now, this would have created absolute havoc with the financing of Social Security. I mean, it was incredibly destructive of it, even though it wasn't a full privatization. Bush made that his top domestic policy agenda after he won re-election in 2004. And then when he was inaugurated in 2005 for the second term, he then just, you know, set out to do this and spoke all over the country. But it was very interesting that the more he explained this and the more he spoke about it, the more opposed people became. And then by August of 2005, it was so clear that the opposition was massive to this plan that the administration abandoned it because it threatened all their other programs. So the way that I think of it is, if there's one thing about retirement that, you know, people get, it's that Social Security is a very good program and to be defended, and you don't want to ruin it. Now, I think that there it's no great mystery why there are interests out there that don't like Social Security, because it is the country's biggest retirement plan, and it means that, you know, all of this money goes through the government rather than going through Wall Street. And Wall Street is absolutely lusting to get a hold of this money from which it can take its commissions and fees and profits and so forth. So anybody who can figure out how to even divert a little bit of Social Security into the private market is going to produce, you know, lots and lots of profits for very wealthy interests in this country.
Not to speak of the fact that then they can invest it in abstruse financial instruments like collateralized debt obligations and the other such like that crashed the economy in 2008.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's a big part of the problem is that the world of high finance continually invents all kinds of ways of describing what it's doing that are beyond anybody to really understand. I mean, people who are listening to this program who are in private accounts, 401k plans, I mean, I would challenge people to how many of them actually understand the statements that they get in the mail from them, the quarterly statements. I mean, the pages and pages of financial statistics. But if you're looking for very particular information, you might not find it in there. It would take a really trained accountant to really figure out what's even in the basic statements. There are all kinds of things that are hidden. Social Security, on the other hand, is extraordinarily transparent in terms of how it works and what it is and what to expect from it.
James W. Russell. We're talking with him about his book, Social Insecurity, 401ks, and the Retirement Crisis. We'll talk more after the break. Don't go away.
When I get older, losing my hair, many years from now, will you still be sending me a Valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine. If I've been out till 2:45, would you lock the door? Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour with James W. Russell, talking about the real causes of the retirement crisis and what to do about it. There are fixes from raising the cap on the amount of income that can be taxed for Social Security to offering nonprofit annuities. We'll hear more about the solutions later. But first, what about the claim that Social Security represents a war by elders on their children? One of the arguments that's always made that we hear all the time is that we're bankrupting our children by not cutting Social Security. That is, the argument seems to have shifted from privatizing Social Security to cutting the benefits. Are we bankrupting our children? And what is your take on, I mean, what has already been done to cut Social Security? What's this all about?
Well, first off, anyone who wants to really read up on Social Security, I highly recommend the book that's just out called Social Security Works by Nancy Altman and Eric Kingson. They are absolute pros and have been following Social Security for many, many years. And they address that particular argument. And one of the things that they point out is, first off, a lot of children benefit from Social Security. There are survivor's benefits that go to children when parents die. There are people who are on disability income who are using that to support families. So there are children right now that benefit from Social Security. But for the future, you know, when you think about it, if Social Security wasn't there for your aged parents, who is going to have to support them? Their adult children, right?
Right.
You know, so there are all kinds of people who benefit from Social Security who are not the aged. You know, it's not really that way in terms of that they're somehow taking the money of the future. So I would just simply disagree with any notion that Social Security is somehow giving an extraordinary amount of money to the aged at the expense of other parts of the population.
Now, you talked about George W. Bush. You talked about George W. Bush's attack on Social Security. First of all, I wanted to ask you, just to go back to that for a moment, why would taking 3% out be so disastrous? I mean, heck, it's only 3%.
Well, it's 3% of income, but it would be something like a quarter of its revenue. You know, if you consider that its revenue is 12.4% of income, then you take 3%, that's nearly a quarter of the revenue that goes into it. So you know, talk about inducing a financial crisis in Social Security, that would really do it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that would really drive it under. It would then have to really reduce benefits if it lost a quarter of its income.
Okay, so back to reducing benefits. It wasn't just the Republicans. Obama seems to have been relentless. I mean, he set up the Simpson-Bowles Commission. He's really pushed cutting benefits to Social Security. He's even pushed the idea of mandatory private contributions. Unpack this for us. Let's first take, you know, the whole, what cuts have already happened, how do they work, and why is he doing this?
Well, again, I say anybody who wants to understand it should go back to the World Bank's 1994 report, Averting the Old Age Crisis, because you find that there are both Democrats and Republicans, you're absolutely right, who are trying to undermine Social Security. The Clinton administration had a whole study to unveil its own form of partial privatization. And the only thing that upended that was that the whole Monica Lewinsky crisis really kept Clinton from being able to do what was going to be a very controversial plan. And so it was just abandoned at that time, and then it was picked up by Bush to do that. I mean, it seemed to me that from the World Bank's point of view, Plan A was always privatization. But if you couldn't do privatization, you then did benefit cut. So what's the advantage of benefit cut? That means that people are more dependent on private accounts because they can't get as much from their public account, okay, which is what Social Security is. That's what the Obama administration tried to do, was to do a mild cut of benefits by adjusting the way in which the cost of living adjustment was calculated. And just like Bush, he got enormous pushback from a wide array of organizations that include, obviously, the AARP, but you know, the organizations of the retired, but also labor organizations, community organizations, religious organizations. Every time there's an attempt to attack or undermine Social Security, there really is a ferocious reaction. I mean, that's why Social Security is called the third rail of American politics. So that's, you know, I mean, the way I'm looking at it, that was kind of Plan B. I mean, I think there's a Plan C that's out there because A and B have been defeated. That Plan C is to do nothing about Social Security. If you do nothing and you don't make the actuarial adjustments over the years, then by 2030, according to the trustees, the account will have to start reducing benefits. And so by lack of action, you could get to kind of the plan B of cutting benefits. Now, on the other hand, the groups that defend Social Security made a very significant transition in strategy about a year ago, which was to move from defending the program from all of these elite attempts to undermine it to now arguing that it needs to be expanded because of the retirement crisis. And that's what they're pushing, especially in the Democratic Party. Now, one might think that expansion is a kind of wild idea, but in fact, four different times in the history of Social Security, it's been expanded, the benefits.
So what does that mean? First of all, what were some of the cuts that were made? Maybe just briefly, tell us what they were. And what would expansion, how should it be expanded? So if you could get those two sides of the question.
Yeah. The last time that, or the only time that benefits have been cut was in 1983 under Reagan and the Greenspan Commission, because then the age of normal retirement was raised. And, you have to think about that for a minute. If you raise it from 65 to 67, that means you start at age 67 with what you would have gotten at 65 before. And so you've lost 2 years of lifetime benefits. And so anytime you raise the age of retirement, you're cutting people's benefits. And so that happened in 1983. Also in 1983 was when they began taxing the benefits. And so that represented a cut. There were a few other parts of it that were kind of more minor in terms of that adjustments that were made. So that was the last time that there was actually a cut. Now, one of the things that the Greenspan Commission hadn't thought about, because nobody had it in 1983, because that was supposed to fix the financing of it, and it would have, except for the fact that we had this roaring inequality in the 80s, 90s, and up to today, so that more and more income of the wealthy has now been removed from taxation for Social Security, because only the first 119,000 of income is taxed for Social Security. I mean 119 is a lot of money, but for people who are really rich and making millions of dollars, it means that more and more of their money escapes Social Security taxation. And so the very inequality has created financing problems for Social Security. Now, all of the plans to expand benefits are premised on removing that cap on income. Because if you remove the cap on income, Social Security revenue increases dramatically, and it has an ability to now pay out higher benefits to people.
In fact, you'd be recapturing some of that shift in income from, 80% of society to the top 20%, or even 99% to the top 1%.
Right, right. I have somewhere, unfortunately, I don't have it right on the top of my head, what percentage of people have income over 119,000, and it's really very small. And so it's really just a very small percentage of people who would end up paying a greater amount for Social Security.
So other than the cap, what reforms are needed in Social Security?
Well, to expand the benefits so that people get more money that would be equivalent to their pre-retirement income.
And you mentioned another one. It's called a nonprofit annuity. What's the advantage of that, especially over a for-profit annuity?
Well, this is a reform for people who are in 401k-type plans. right now, when you retire, there aren't very many good options for what you can do with your money during the spend down phase. The experts say you should not take more than 4% out. You can also purchase an annuity that'll get you 5 to 7%, you know, per year of whatever you give. So if you give $100,000, you get $5,000 to $7,000 per year, depending upon whether it has some sort of a cost of living adjustment in it. And that's not a very good option. The reason for that, why they aren't very good options, is that, once again, the financial services industry takes a lot of profits and commissions out of even the annuities. And so they've kind of got you coming and going. You know, they take a lot out during the accumulation phase and a lot out during the spend down phase. If you could, on the other hand, have annuities issued that were on a nonprofit basis, you could get a lot more returns. And I know some examples of that that are not really open to the general public, okay, but where the difference is between, I would say you would get about 20 to 30% more if you could get a nonprofit annuity. Now, who could issue a nonprofit annuity? Number one, Social Security could do it, okay, assuming there was legislation to allow them to do that. And in fact, back in 1935, when Social Security was set up, that was going to be one of its features, is that people could take their savings and purchase nonprofit annuities. But the banks were opposed to it, so it didn't become a part of it. So that's a possibility. There's also a possibility on state levels, because a number of states are dealing with the retirement crisis by setting up kind of public option individual retirement accounts. Those accounts, at least in theory, could also issue nonprofit annuities, assuming that they're not prohibited from doing that. Right now, there's no law on the subject that would prohibit them from doing it. But the legislation, depending on how it's crafted, will either allow or not allow. So I would say that that second reform is something that people in 401ks should be very attentive to and support.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with James W. Russell about his book, Social Insecurity, 401ks and the Retirement Crisis. It's an alternative view of the retirement crisis than the one you tend to hear in the national media. Now, one thing we haven't talked about yet, and has been much in the news, is the whole issue of public sector pensions. I mean, the private sector pensions have already been transferred to privatizing the risk or creating the risk for the employee in these defined contribution plans. And those are for people who even have any kind of 401k or pension, because probably most workers don't anymore. But talk about the public sector pensions. We hear that there's just not the money to pay them.
Right. The main problem of public sector pensions, before I even say that, is there are a number of public sector pensions that are in very good shape financially. I mean, I'm still waiting for a newspaper article about a pension plan that's in good shape. I mean, we're always having, you know, stories about those that are in bad shape. Now, if you look at why a pension plan is in bad shape, it's almost inevitably not because it paid out too generous benefits. It's because it wasn't funded properly. What happens over the years with state legislatures and governors is it becomes very tempting when they're in a budget crunch to not make the contribution to the pension plan. Okay, and they can generally get away with it for two reasons. Number one is they'll be out of office before there's any problem. Okay, and number two, it won't provoke an immediate problem. It just provokes a long-term financing problem. And so we've got an accumulation of unfunded liabilities. Okay, but that was of no fault of the employees. Okay, that was simply the way in which this was irresponsibly dealt with over the years. I mean, it's sort of like if you're paying for a house and you stop making your full payment, I mean, this thing is going to mount as a problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you still owe the money, okay, but now it's a much bigger problem. Okay, well, that's essentially the problem that states are in. I think that the whole issue of the unfunded liabilities of some plans is probably one of those issues that, I don't know, never have more people believe something so fervently that wasn't true. That is, they believe that these are about to bankrupt state governments. They're not. They can be managed over the long term. There are no imminent crises. Okay, but there are a lot of people using the whole issue of the unfunded liabilities to try to scare state legislatures and state populations into privatizing more public pensions.
Not to speak of attacking the union movement, which is where so many public employees are in.
Right, right, absolutely.
Now, you brought the battle right to the industry in your own state of Connecticut. This is a really thrilling part of the book. You know, I can imagine it as a movie. You know, one guy goes up against the financial services industry in his state and really makes a difference. Tell us what you did and what happened.
Well, it wasn't entirely one guy. I mean, it was, you know, because when I first figured all of this out and I would tell people, even those people who agreed with me, nothing happened. Only something began to happen when people were organized. So I used skills I had learned in the civil rights movement and elsewhere to begin building a rank-and-file movement in six different unions in the state that had members who stood to benefit by a reform. And so we got together. A lot of people put pressure on the unions to take up the issue.
And the issue
unions
was,
had not taken up the issue, we would not have gotten anywhere because they had the resources and the contacts.
And tell us what exactly was the issue.
Well, the issue was that the 401k type plan that we were in, first off, took a huge hit in 2008, but even in good years, it was still not paying off anything close to what people who were in the state pension were getting. And that was something people could see. I mean, people had worked the same number of years, had earned the same amount of money, but were now looking forward to a retirement in near poverty when they had colleagues who were planning trips to Europe and, you know, had quite a fine retirement ahead of them. So there was a transparency that could be seen. And then, again, you know, the rude awakening of 2008. So the only solution to that I could see was to allow us to take the money we had built up in the 401k plan and roll it into the state pension plan and receive credit. And, you know, did all the math on it, and, you know, to surrender the money that you had built up for credits in the state pension plan was a really good deal if you got it. Okay, and so that was the reform that we were asking for, and it was a reform that would clearly benefit us as employees, but it would also benefit the state of Connecticut because the pension plan was cheaper to finance than this 401k that we had. It would also allow people to retire. I mean, we had people working, you know, up close to 80 years old because they couldn't retire under this 401k type plan. But once they got a real pension, they would be able to retire. Or they were at the top of their salary. So there were all kinds of advantages for both us and the employer, which was the state. And you know, it took 4 years to do that, and eventually we got the state to agree and to set it up so that we could do that. And you know, so far, 1,800 people have done that. And, you know, a lot of money has rolled from this 401k type plan into the state pension fund, and now something like 300 people have retired under the system who would not have been able to retire before.
Opening up jobs for younger people.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so what kind of a difference has it made in your retirement prospects?
Well, immense. I mean, I am planning on actually retiring in about 2 months, and I would not have been able to retire without having done this.
Well, congratulations. And congratulations on this terrific book, Social Insecurity, 401ks and the Retirement Crisis. We've been talking with James W. Russell. He's a professor at Eastern Connecticut State University. The book is out from Beacon Press. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
And thank you for having me on.
Read an excerpt from James W. Russell's book, Social Insecurity, by going to writersvoice.net. You can also find links to organizations that are fighting to expand Social Security. Let's go out with some words from Senator Elizabeth Warren about that fight.
Just this morning, The Washington Post ran an editorial mocking the idea of a looming retirement crisis. To make sure that no one missed the point, they even put the words retirement crisis in quotation marks. No retirement crisis? Tell that to the millions of Americans who are facing retirement without a pension. Tell that to the millions of Americans who have nothing to fall back on except Social Security. There is a $6.6 trillion gap between what Americans under 65 are currently saving and what they need to maintain their standard of living when they hit retirement. $6.6 trillion. And that assumes that Social Security benefits aren't cut. Make no mistake, there is a crisis. The Washington Post framed the choice as more children in poverty versus more seniors in poverty. The suggestion that we have become a country where those living in poverty fight each other for a handful of crumbs tossed off the tables of the very wealthy is fundamentally wrong. We don't build a future for our children by cutting basic retirement benefits for their grandparents. No, we build a future for our kids by strengthening our economy.
That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.